Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, one and all, Pam Chaddock, Andre Rebatis, Chuck Thurston, and Marvin Garin. Hi, you guys.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
Happy summer.
Yeah.
Happy summer. Happy Midsummer's Day. Happy St. John's Day. Happy National Day for Quebec. Yay!
Yay. Gee, Andre, that was a good rundown.
Yeah.
I liked it. There's always something going on every day.
Yeah.
If I've learned anything in my 68 years, it's that.
Yeah. The Feast of John the Baptist. Yeah.
Ah, okay. Wow.
St. John's Day. And many there are a number of cultures that celebrate this. It's made Midsummer Day and called Yanni to mean, John's Day in Latvian culture. And it's the Since Saint Jean-Baptiste is the patron saint of Quebec, it is Quebec's national day. So they have their national day off. It's their 4th of July in Quebec today.
Wow. That's awesome to know.
Yeah.
Interesting. We're here to celebrate.
Yes, there we go. And we're on, just so our listeners know, we're on paper four. And paper four is God's relation to the universe. And we'll be reading today section two, God and Nature. And I wanted to pose a question to you guys before we get started, because this section is, to me, about this very idea, this erroneous idea that humans often have, that God visits disasters upon humanity, uses nature to punish us. And this has been, it sounds like a primitive belief, and it indeed it is a primitive belief. But it's still really prevalent. It's still amazingly prevalent. Even
well, there is a reason. There's a reason it's prevalent.
Because we're going through so much or always going through so much?
No, so long as Christianity insists, and for that matter, Judaism insists on promoting that version of God as written in a sacred book. I mean, that's the kind of God you have in the Old Testament.
It's Old Testament,
one that smites those enemies. I get to read about that every day in my Episcopalian prayer group. And, you know, to the extent that people believe that, hook, line, and sinker, which I don't know that everybody in, say, more progressive Christian circles do, but there are plenty of fundamentalists out there who say, no, it's the sacred word of the Bible. Got to believe it. Doesn't matter what Jesus Christ said. Doesn't matter what Michael of Nebadon as Jesus of Nazareth, Joshua ben Joseph, was saying, because for that matter, many of the gospel writers recapitulated some of those Old Testament words and put them in Jesus' mouth. I mean, they've got Jesus causing a fig tree to wither in Luke because it didn't produce food for Jesus as he walked by. That's not in the Urantia book, but it is in the Bible.
That's a strange one.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah.
Well, you know, we still that's built into our legal and insurance idea, you know, the acts of God are memorialized in terms of the insurance policies.
You know, I guess what occurs to me is that this relates to the anthropomorphic understanding of God. I mean, we tend to cast God in our own image, and the more primitive, you know, the more primitive were the times, the more we tended to do that. We project out of our own nature, our own angers, our own selfishness, our own transactional kinds of relationships where, you know, you give me what I want, if I give you what I want, give you what you want. Those are very human ways of interacting. And those are the ways that earlier forms of religion portray God. And what's so interesting is the Urantia book basically says it's utterly the other way around. You know, the fundamental nature of reality is expressed in God's nature, and we should be trying to reach for God's nature and slowly transforming human nature instead of the other way around, that we change God's nature to reflect our own. And so, you know, I mean, I think slowly, steadily, religion is moving to this idea that the whole purpose of the spiritual quest is to be transformed for us, to be transformed by God, you know. Right. Yeah, and the Urantia book was a forefront of that effort, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the capacity of love. So I think it boils down to how much love we have in our experience, in our reality. Because if God is love, that's our achievement. That's our desire, our aspiration. So to the degree that we're not in acting out of love is the equation that we're all, and we all do it on different levels at different times. So,
right.
Yeah.
Well,
I remember,
you know, go ahead, Chuck.
Oh, I was just going to say quickly, long before I found the Urantia book, you know, when I was puzzling over questions about the nature and existence of God, probably the first two inputs to that, you know, one of them was this thing about acts of God that show up, you know, in legal language. And the other was in God we trust, which is on the money, right?
Mm-hmm.
So trying to reconcile those two concepts. Wait a second. God is acting through nature to make, create tornadoes and earthquakes and stuff, but yet at the same time we should trust him.
Yeah. In terms of money.
Yeah. Well, yeah, at least that far. Anyway, well, I mean, the implication being in God we trust as a country or culture or something. But I found that, you know, hard to reconcile.
Well, yeah.
So that was part of my confusion that eventually led me to the Orange Book. But...
And, you know, in thinking about the stories, too, Noah and the flood, okay, directly blamed on God. You know, I mean, I've heard many, many times modern evangelicals and big, huge mega pastors like Pat Robertson, who blamed, you know, Katrina on gays. I think it was gays in the military or something. I don't mean to make light of it because it's not light. It just seems so absurd. And the reason I bring it up is because I think this section we're about to read deals directly with that. And I think mm-hmm. they're trying to disabuse us of that notion that God is using nature in any way to punish us.
It's
our job
idea.
To tame nature and to learn to live with nature and you know, in honor of nature, the ways of nature, you know, to respect it. And I think we are up to, you know, in terms of humanity is up to nature. We can learn to live with nature and even manage nature in such a way that it wouldn't be so devastating to us.
Well, you know, we ought to, since we've segued pretty well into this, why don't we jump into the reading and then we can discuss more on the other side? Because, you know, people that might be tuning in for the first time and not completely familiar with the Urantia book may not understand where things are coming from and why there is this statement about, you know, the problem with looking at God this way. And this section deals with some of that. And on the other side, I think we can talk about that. I appreciate Marvin bringing up, you know, how anthropomorphized, you know, God mm-hmm. has become in human religion. Basically, let's dumb down God, therefore we don't have to be as good.
Yes. Right.
Yes.
Right. Make him like us instead of striving to be like him.
Right.
You know,
anyway, somebody should start reading. Let's go for it.
Well, I can read it, guys. I'm happy.
Why don't you do
that?
Okay.
Here is a section 2 from paper 4, God and Nature. Nature is in a limited sense the physical habit of God. The conduct or action of God is qualified and provisionally modified by the experimental plans and the evolutionary patterns of a local universe, a constellation, a system, or a planet. God acts in accordance with a well-defined, unchanging, immutable law throughout the wide-spreading master universe. But he modifies the patterns of his action so as to contribute to the coordinate and balanced conduct of each universe, constellation, system, planet, and personality in accordance with the local objects, aims, and plans of the finite projects of evolutionary unfolding. Therefore, nature, as mortal man understands it, presents the underlying foundation and fundamental background of a changeless deity and his immutable laws, modified by, fluctuating because of, and experiencing upheavals through the working of the local plans, purposes, patterns, and conditions, which have been inaugurated and are being carried out by the local universe, constellation, system, and planetary forces and personalities. For example, as God's laws have been ordained in Nevadon, they are modified by the plans established by the Creator Son and Creative Spirit of this local universe. And in addition to all this, the operation of these laws has been further influenced by the errors, defaults, and insurrections of certain beings resident upon your planet and belonging to your immediate planetary system of Satania. Nature is a time-space resultant of two cosmic factors. First, the immutability, perfection, and rectitude of Paradise Deity. And second, the experimental plans, executive blunders, insurrectionary errors, incompleteness of development, and imperfection of wisdom of the extra paradise creatures, from the highest to the lowest. Nature therefore carries a uniform, unchanging, majestic, and marvelous thread of perfection from the circle of eternity. But in each universe, on each planet, and in each individual life, this nature is modified, qualified, and perchance marred by the acts, the mistakes, and the disloyalties of the creatures of the evolutionary systems and universes. And therefore must nature ever be of a changing mood, whimsical withal, though stable underneath, and varied in accordance with the operating procedures of a local universe. Nature is the perfection of paradise, divided by the incompletion, evil, and sin of the unfinished universes. This quotient is thus expressive of both the perfect and the partial, of both the eternal and the temporal. Continuing evolution modifies nature by augmenting the content of paradise perfection and by diminishing the content of the evil, error, and disharmony of relative reality. God is not personally present in nature or in any of the forces of nature, for the phenomenon of nature is the superimposition of the imperfections of progressive evolution and sometimes the consequences of insurrectionary rebellion upon the paradise foundations of God's universal law. As it appears on such a world as Urantia, nature can never be the adequate expression, the true representation, the faithful portrayal of an all-wise and infinite God. Nature on your world is a qualification of the laws of perfection by the evolutionary plans of the local universe. What a travesty to worship nature, because it is in a limited, qualified sense pervaded by God, because it is a phase of the universal and therefore divine power. Nature also is a manifestation of the unfinished, the incomplete, the imperfect outworkings of the development, growth, and progress of a universe experiment in cosmic evolution. The apparent defects of the natural world are not indicative of any such corresponding defects in the character of God. Rather, are such observed imperfections merely the inevitable stop moments in the exhibition of the ever-moving reel of infinity picturization? It is these very defect interruptions of perfection continuity which make it possible for the finite mind of material man to catch a fleeting glimpse of divine reality in time and space. The material manifestations of divinity appear defective to the evolutionary mind of man only because mortal man persists in viewing the phenomena of nature through natural eyes, human vision unaided by Marantia Moda or by revelation, its compensatory substitute on the world of time. and nature is marred. Her beautiful face is scarred. Her features are seared by the rebellion, the misconduct, the misthinking of the myriads of creatures who are a part of nature, but who have contributed to her disfigurement in time. No, nature is not God. Nature is not an object of worship.
Nicely read, Paula.
Thank you. Beautifully read.
Mm-hmm. It's so thought-provoking, isn't it? I mean, especially as we look at what's going on, you know, and I'll just say climate change, for instance. Our climate scientists have said we're having an impact. We humans are having an impact on the climate of this world. And if I'm reading this correctly, that's what it's saying, that we can have an impact on our net. And why is that a surprise to us? Why would that be a shock to us when we know we've already been through so many iterations of cleaning up our air and cleaning up our water and, you know, trying not to disrupt the natural patterns, these immutable laws of nature, which, if I understand it correctly, will work for us and not against us if we will learn to work in harmony with them. And, you know, and this is such a grand scale, right, what's happening. So it's just, to me, maybe perhaps at this time, one of the more important sections in the whole book, you know, that we understand the implications of our participation in this. And mm-hmm. that, you know, we do have, you know, for me, it's like, and I'm sorry, I'm going on, but it's like we have a blank canvas and all the beautiful colors and the paints, you know, and God, and that's nature. God provided the canvas and all of the beautiful colors. And we get to create something of that. It's like when we make a garden again, you know. We get to take the raw materials and make something beautiful, something lasting. Or we can just create discord, you know, a jumble of nothing much. So.
Yeah, I was thinking, Paula, about, you know, the implications of this section for our human situation, and I was also thinking about our world environment, and you know, I think as our technologies become more and more powerful in their impact, that factor starts to become more and more critical, not only in the quality of our environment, but our very survival. So I was thinking on that level, but I was also struck by something in the middle of the third paragraph where they say nature therefore carries a uniform, unchanging, majestic, and marvelous thread of perfection from the circle of eternity. But then they say it's qualified, but in each universe, on each planet, and I was struck by, and in each individual life, this nature mm-hmm. is modified, qualified, and perchance marred by the mm-hmm. action, the mistakes, the loyalty, disloyalties. So, you know, this is very personal as well. I mean, it's our very health, our physiological health, our mental mm-hmm. health, that's impacted by our misunderstandings and our poor prioritizations as human beings, you know, when we choose the wrong things. And, I mean, you can see that in people's individual lives, you know, ending sometimes in disaster, the poor choices, how it affects their physical mechanism and their lives. So I think it's functioning on many, many levels, not just planetary. And they seem to imply that it's happening on a, you know, on a system and constellation and even universe level. Mm-hmm. So that the mm-hmm. decisions that our leaders are making at the highest levels are also affecting us. You know, we didn't really talk about this coming into the program, but, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on as we speak in the geopolitics of the country, of the world right now. And it's just interesting to see the outworking of values in not only individual lives, in ways that affect, I mean, hundreds and thousands of human beings caught up in strife and in military kinds of confrontations, but how it plays out in the acts of society, the acts of human leaders, and it's like chaos begets chaos and violence begets violence, and the ignorance of these natural laws ricochets down and affects people in so many different levels. I know I'm talking kind of abstractly, but I don't know if you all are paying attention to the situation that's going on in Russia right now. As we're speaking, I mean, there's sort of a civil war happening, and somehow this is really related to deception. When they talk about the mishaps of human nature, the poor choices, and the outworking of really what I would call Luciferian ideologies that are small-minded, they're self-centered, and they're often ruthless in their outworking, and you see the results, the repercussions of that, not only in our environment and in the impacts in our world, but in our cultures and in individual human lives. It's just happening on so many different levels. You see the chaos as it's affecting our world. And you think about how different the world would be if the values that Jesus portrayed were holding sway in people's lives and in the lives of the leaders of our nations. You know, I mean, we have a long, long ways to go in. You just see the outworking of these warnings in this section happening on a global scale, you know, in the climate and in the culture and in individual lives. It's sobering, very sobering.
It is sobering. You know, that's a good word for it.
Sobering is a good word, yes. And given all these different factors that are influencing the outcomes, I'm scratching my head and wondering how we made it as far as we have. It kind of indicates just how powerful our guidance is within and externally. Because, I mean, we are eking out something here that is totally, not to mention an experimental planet on top of it. The factors are even more, stretched. but it's almost like things are coming to a head, you know, like you were saying, Marvin. So Interregnum could very well be, you know, coming up soon. But I'm still amazed that we've made it as far as we have. And I don't know, this paper is just a real clarification of all the factors that are playing out on this planet. I like the fact that you brought out in each individual life, because that's where we can affect whatever from our perspective.
That's where it begins, right? It begins in the consciousness of individuals to be kinder to the environment, to live in respect and harmony with the environment. But I want to throw out a question that Gina asked on the board, because it's important. She said it is confusing what is meant here by nature. And so she looked up nature. And I guess it would be important for us to define, you know, she looked it up in the 1924 dictionary. And the first definition is birth and origin. The second one is that which is the source or essence of life, creative force, the sum and order of causes and effects in time and space, the powers which produce existing phenomena, whether in the total or in detail, the agencies which carry on the processes of creation or of being, often conceived as a single or separate entity, embodying the total of all finite agencies and forces as disconnected from creating or ordering intelligence. And it goes on from there. I mean, that's quite a description from that mm-hmm. from that dictionary, 1924 dictionary. And then the third one is, what is that which is produced by natural forces? The existing system of things in time and space, the world of matter, or of matter and mind, creation, the universe. So I don't know. I of those three, I think that the Urantia book was going with the third definition, but I don't know how you guys feel about that. You know, how do you define, how would you define their meanings of nature?
Well, it's clear that the ideas of nature were trending in that direction, and the revelators would have seen that. And for their purposes, they certainly didn't want to, I mean, they weren't disavowing nature as being something that had to have a creative origin. We have the origin of life as having a, you know, celestial origin, essentially, with the life carriers, that there is no life without it being planted there, without it being created in some fashion and incepted by some kind of force that, for lack of a better term, we call life or life force, right?
Right.
So they clearly are looking at it that way, but at the same time, they're making sure to differentiate it from the primitive idea of the hand of God in everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, that God is not a micromanager. God does not have mm-hmm. his hand on absolutely every pulse. Right now, we have Kilauea gearing up to another lava flow. We have as well the Filipino volcano Mayon that is at a level 3 and that they're watching very closely and that they still have not degraded because they think it may be still on the upswing. And they have people evacuated within a 6-kilometer radius. So that's science looking at that, but there are still plenty of people that attribute spiritual forces to purely natural phenomenon. We are not in a fully scientific age as much as we would like to be. Science has not captivated the entire population. Furthermore, when you look at statistics on scientific literacy, it's, I don't think, ever exceeded 25 to 30% of the population that have any appreciable knowledge of basic science. The rest is up for grabs. That is troublesome. I mean, and that that holds to, you know, our people that are lawmakers as well, you know. If you only have a third of the people that are scientifically literate, what hope do you have of actually having laws that correspond with the nature of reality as it's understood objectively? Just that part of it, let alone all the primitive ideas about religion out there and the primitive ideas about God.
Mm-hmm. You know, as I look at the 20th century, and the age of industry. And I think, again, you know, this was not a surprise to our overseers, our celestial overseers, or those who watch the progress of our planet so carefully and take care to guide us as best they can without any material boots on the ground necessarily. I mean, if Adam and Eve were here, if a loyal planetary prince and his regime were here, they would have guided us through the pitfalls of this age. And so I think in a way we blundered into it. and we've blundered into our machines and our conveniences. And in many ways, our human nature, say the vicissitudes of our human nature, which is one is sloth, right? We've convenienced ourselves almost to death now. And we don't, you know, we don't really want to work that hard at getting here or there. That's one of them. Another one is greed. When we found that there was a big appetite for something, we ran with it. We didn't think, we didn't try to think it out and what might the consequences be. And it's not that, you know, more primitive humans didn't have issues like this. I mean, they understood you don't drink downstream of the herd, you know. You don't, they had issues too that they had to deal with, you know, locusts and stuff like, you know, issues of nature that, that were devastating to them. But there was a kind of innocence in it. But with the age of industry, we lost a lot of that innocence. And all of a sudden, you know, the potential for greed and I don't know, you know, it just seems like, to me, it just seems like the world has become a classic addict. And we have a few pushers out there, a few dealers who are dealing us our main drug, and our main drug, our drug of choice is oil. And we're killing ourselves with it. And I'd, you know, I'd love for you guys to change my mind about that. You know, really, I would. I'd love for you to tell me, no, 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 it's not, that's not what's happening. But, you know, suddenly I see, you know, certain players, some of the biggest dealers of this drug in the world, now pushing their agenda. And it's scary because we are so dependent on it now. And it's clearly not a good place for us to be. And the way I would describe it is, why on earth have we kept digging in the ground for finite resources when we know there are infinite ones that that God has willingly provided, lovingly provided us? You know, we're not letting nature be on our side. We're not working with nature. We're working against it, in my opinion, you know. And that's to our detriment. We're doing it to ourselves. It's not like something that's being done to us. We're all participating. The whole world is participating in this. And it's just, you know, we talk about the interregnum, and I before we came on today, I was telling Andre about a friend. I'm in a spiritual support group, and she lives in South Africa, and she's 82 years old. And she's been telling us for months that South Africa is deteriorating, and it's just become completely absorbed by corruption and every man for himself kind of thing. So civilization in South Africa, we talk about the interregnum, it's happening there. It's disintegrating. Mm-hmm. And here's this 82-year-old woman who raised her family there. And if you've ever been there, I was in Cape Town in 1999. It was one of the most beautiful cities I've ever been to. She doesn't live in Cape Town. She's outside of Johannesburg, but she said, nobody's safe anymore. And just the other night, her her son-in-law, 59-year-old son-in-law, is the head of security at a plant that manages copper. They lured him in and shot him, killed him, so they can steal his, you know, steal the plant's copper. And so, you know, I guess it speaks to me of how fragile we are, and how easily these things that we've so painstakingly built up over the centuries, the rewards of our modern life, the conveniences of our modern life. They don't even have electricity. They have it. It's been diminishing. They have it one, you know, for 8 hours a day, and then it went down to 4 hours a day, and now they're lucky if they have it 1 hour a day. This is in South Africa. And the roads are so bad that you can't drive over them anymore. And, you know, here's this vulnerable 82-year-old woman trying to live in that. And my heart goes out to her. Mm-hmm. There's nothing I could do for her except pray, you know. And so as we talk about these problems that face humanity, we have to realize that at some place then the rubber then meets the road, and there's a real situation going on with climate, for instance, with climate change and these devastating tornadoes that have decimated so many towns in America. Yes. Now
yes, yeah, you know what, I
that's
what
not
I,
a natural occurrence.
I tend to go to the fact that the revelation does tell us that this planet is not settled yet, and that, like Andre was saying, we've got these volcanoes that are still alive. And given everything you're talking about, Paula, I keep coming back to, it's not nice to fool Mother Nature. You know,
oh,
and I don't think
you can't.
I don't think that's just a cliche. It's
yeah.
like she will, she's reacting. She will react. She will have her say in all of this. It, in other words, maybe that's part of what Interregnum is a resettling,
a reset.
You know, a reset. Yeah. So, I mean, it doesn't answer the specifics of your concern, but that's what I kind of see out in the ethers, in if we can't get a handle on this. So, and there is so much good happening at the same time, and it just doesn't get the press.
No, you're either. Right.
So, I am very fascinated with what's happening in Russia and Moscow right now. So that's an interesting turn. We'll see where it goes. But things continue to open up and evolve and you know, readjust. So it's just another reason why this revelation is so vital, because it gives us the big picture and the hope for how we can reconstruct. So anyway, I tend to go abstract.
No, I think it's important. I think that, you know, I hope that at least my understanding of so many of the people that I love who, you know, maybe were hippies in one day, and they became all about natural medicine, and they became all about nature, and they became all about living in harmony with the earth. And they were the first ones that I recall to start to sound the alarm about some of the things that we were doing as humans that might be detrimental to us all.
Rachel Carson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would say that, you know, as best they can, they were just trying to help the situation. Maybe they didn't help it. Maybe they didn't do so much good. But what I've heard for many years is them sounding the alarm about climate change, about many things, you know. And it would be good for us, I think, to reflect on that. To reflect on, you know, and it seems like we're heading in that direction. We're trying to develop alternate forms of energy. We're trying to retool. And maybe it will happen sooner than, you know, sooner than we think. and will restore some balance to the imbalance that we've created.
We might as well read the passage. The word interregnum has come up a few times in the conversation, and mm-hmm. I think it's pretty relevant, pretty pertinent to our whole conversation here and to the section we've just read. The word is an interesting word. It means a time of sort of chaos in between stable and established regimes, right? It is an interregnum. Mm-hmm. It's a time of transition, of fluidity, and sometimes of chaos and disorder. And it separates, one period and another of stability and where things are ordered. So the passage is 118:8-6, and it's the only place in the Urantia book that the word interregnum appears. So it's very easy to find. So I'll go ahead and read it. The slowness of evolution of human cultural progress testifies to the effectiveness of that break, material inertia. So material inertia is the break, which so efficiently operates to retard dangerous velocities of progress. Thus, this time itself, and you can think about time and material inertia as part of nature, it's related to our conversation. Thus, this time itself cushion and distribute the otherwise lethal results of premature escape from the next encompassing barriers to human action. And this is where they sort of explain what they're framing here. For when culture advances over fast, when material achievement outruns the evolution of worship, wisdom, then does civilization contain within itself the seeds of retrogression. And unless buttressed by the swift augmentation of experiential wisdom, such human societies will recede from high but premature levels of attainment and the, quote, dark ages, unquote, of the interregnum of wisdom will bear witness to the inexorable restoration of the imbalance between self-liberty and self-control. It's an incredibly sophisticated statement.
Thank you for bringing that in.
Yeah, sociologically and historically, I keep coming back to the phrase in there. There are two expressions of it: the evolution of worship wisdom, and the swift augmentation of experiential wisdom. So those are two forms of wisdom, right? Wisdom that is gained from experience, but the wisdom that comes and that can only come from worshipful contact with divinity, where we are inspired by these higher seminal ideals, the paradise values that must guide us. So those are two forms of wisdom. And the other theme here is that our material progress has outrun our wisdom, our spiritual connectivity. So, that's a big piece of it. And I continue to find this, when I look at the news of the day and you see how people are acting, there's a flavor to the way people are acting that is impregnated with spiritual value. There's a loving nature. There's a larger perspective, and a perspective that encompasses a larger expanse of humanity in terms of how some of our leaders are proceeding and others are not. You look for the marks of that worship wisdom playing out in the articulation of values and policies and actions. Yeah. And you look for that and you see it in the world. So what I say in response to some of what you've been saying, Paul, is there's a a tremendous tug of war that's going on for the spiritual values, in a sense, the soul of the world, you know. And our revelation has been given to us at a period of tremendous turmoil and struggle between sets of values that are Luciferian on the one hand and Jesusonian on the other. And it's I think that's what they mean by the current ideological struggle. And we are, man, we are smack dab in the middle of it.
Yeah, we are. It sure seems like it.
Yeah.
So if we had Adam and Eve here, what do you think they'd how would they help us? What would they ask us to do you think?
Well, I think a few things just come to mind, but they're so obvious that it's almost like, you know, kindergarten. Is they would be urging our governments, I do think they would be urging our governments to develop, because that's what they try to do. They try to bring in and associate representational forms of government. They attempted to bring in different groups and teach them methods of harmony and peaceful coexistence and cooperation. They attempted to establish values related to wise and scientifically guided participation in the environment and with nature, so that, you know, it would be a cooperative and progressive endeavor. So I think all the things we're talking about, they would be attempting to do. And I think what we're missing is they would constitute the authority that had a celestial association with it. And so there would be a natural attempt for the best of humanity to work together with them. And that's, I think, what we're missing. We're missing sense of higher celestial coherence in how we're approaching these things.
Well, Chuck, you've been awfully quiet. What do you think about all do you think that this is like just another phase of the planet? I mean, I go back to George Carlin, something he said in a comedy routine once, which I'll admit was very, it made me chuckle. He said, you know, people are so worried about the planet, but the planet, it will be fine. The planet is getting ready to shake us off like a bad case of fleas. I had to laugh at that, right? He posited maybe the planet wanted plastic, and now that it has plastic, it doesn't need us. You know, stuff like that, which is, you know, not an uncommon idea, I think. A lot of it is just nature working, doing what nature does, and we have to react in some regard. But what do we do as spiritual people to help others through this struggle, especially when they believe that God is doing this to us? Any thoughts on that?
I wonder if you could take another look at paragraph 7. A couple of pretty interesting things in that paragraph. If you don't mind, maybe I'll just read it again, and then we can, I don't know, there's a couple of things here that I think are worth pointing out and maybe talking about a little bit. They say that the apparent defects of the natural world are not indicative of any such corresponding defects in the character of God. Okay,
right.
That's good news. But then there's this really intriguing sentence. They say, rather are such observed imperfections merely the inevitable stop moments in the exhibition of the ever-moving reel of infinity picturization. And this next sentence is the one I hope we can maybe focus on a little bit. It says, it is these very defect interruptions of perfection continuity which make it possible for the finite mind of material man to catch a fleeting glimpse of divine reality in time and space. So that seems kind of counterintuitive, that it would be the defects that allow us to catch a glimpse of divine reality. But then they go on to say, the material manifestations of divinity appear defective to the evolutionary mind of man only because mortal man persists in viewing the phenomena of nature through natural eyes, human vision, unaided by Mirantra Moda or by revelation, its compensatory substitute on the world of time. So right there, they're telling us how important revelation is, because it functions in the place of Moda. You know, we don't have Mirantra mind quite yet. You know, maybe toward the end of our lives, some of us reach superimposition of Mirantra mind. But in the meantime, we have to depend on revelation to give us this higher perspective that'll, you know, release us from our persistence in viewing the phenomena of nature only through our material eyes. So that's one thing. But this thing about the defects making it possible to catch a glimpse of, fleeting glimpse of divine reality, I wonder what you guys think about that. I mean, the contrast, maybe? Or our attempt to comprehend it or to understand it.
Maybe that's it, Chuck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it is their defect interruptions. Here, I thought of you when I read this. You know, here's these hyphenated words, which you point out to us. It is these very defect.
Right.
And so maybe it's only in reflection upon, wow, we're in a world of hurt right now. Let's reflect on how we got here. And
does this tie in? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Sam.
I'm jumping into the Moda that says, only from the isolated depths are you able to see the stars. So I'm just wondering if that ties in with this sentence, because the divine reality, you know, is seen, like you did say, Chuck, is seen in opposition to,
The contrast of
maybe. I have you guys ever seen the movie The Biggest Little Farm?
Mm-mm.
Have you ever watched that?
Not heard of it.
Mm-mm.
It's a guy and his wife who decided they didn't like the urban life anymore, and they wanted to buy a farm. And it just so happens that this guy is a documentary filmmaker, and I can't remember now what his wife was doing. But they bought this farm in California, and it was dead. The farm was dead. But they wanted to really give it a shot. And it took 7 years, interestingly, 7 years to turn this farm around from a dead farm to a living farm. And they hired this guy who is... he was an old codger, but he knew exactly what they needed to do to get the environment of this farm to work for itself and not against itself, and to use the natural world to do the things they needed to have done, like if they had an insect problem, how they could manage that. If they had, you know, I think at one point they had a slug problem, and they, you know, and he showed them all the natural ways to get this farm to be the dynamic living organism that it is, that it naturally is. It took 7 years, but they completely turned it around. And I hate to give away the plot, because this guy documents every year of their life there and everything they had to do, the ups and downs. It's one of the most moving movies I've ever seen, and one of the most hopeful, because it really shows that there is a way, a natural way, to get nature to work for us rather than against us, right? We always seem to overreact. You know, it's like, was it you, Pam, that said it? Or no, it was Marvin, maybe. It's really simple, really. There's something so simple we need to do. And maybe Adam and Eve would be showing us the obvious. But while you were reading that, Chuck, about revelations, it also occurred to me, and another point is that Adam and Eve were not just a moment in, were not intended to be a moment in time revelation. They were intended to be an ongoing one.
Mm-hmm.
And a demonstration.
Yes, right.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was the name of that
boy,
movie?
Boy, some of these. It's called The Biggest Little Farm, and I highly recommend it. May
I put it in the chat
on my birthday? Yeah. May took me to see it, Glenn and I, to see it on my birthday 1 year. And just one of the most moving, beautiful films. And I think it's streaming now on Netflix or one of those streaming services. But I highly recommend it because it's just such an amazing document of human perseverance and hope and belief in the best ways of doing things, which this old codger teaches this young couple. And they, of course, absolutely fall in love with him and learn to just be totally guided by him. And he never lets them down. He just keeps reassuring them, no, you got to just keep, mm-hmm. And it's just so endearing. So endearing that movie is. Anyway, I think it gives me hope because I think we can, learn to live in harmony with the natural world. And
that kind of fits with that sentence about the defect interruptions.
Right.
It's like the guy was being coached how to overcome those. And in overcoming them, he got a fleeting glimpse of, how things could be.
That's such a good point, Chuck. That is exactly what it shows you. That's exactly what that movie shows you. How to overcome the interregnum, because that farm was definitely in an interregnum. It had been pesticided and, chemical. The earth on this farm is just really dead. It's not producing anything. Mm-hmm. And he shows them how to turn that around. It's really beautiful and poignant. But I want to share a quote too. This is from Paper 70, and I know I've shared it. We actually read this on air. We were studying this paper together, 70, and this quote just hit me so hard, and it's been with me ever since. Because I reflect on it often. It's Paper 70, Section 9, Paragraph 1. Nature confers no rights on man, only life and a world in which to live it. Nature does not even confer the right to live, as might be deduced by considering what likely would happen if an unarmed man met a hungry tiger face to face in the primitive forest. Society's prime gift to man is security. When we read that together, that just, and I wanted to read it because it seems so complementary to what we just read, right? Nature confers no rights on man, only life and a world in which to live it. It doesn't even give us the right to live. But we have to create that for each other. That's our gift.
Mm-hmm.
That's our
mm-hmm.
gift to ourselves and to each other and to our children and our children's children. Security.
Yeah.
Which we saw that in the garden, right? One of the first things they did was create a secure environment in which they could all live.
That's right. They had balls, you're right.
I'm trying to connect in the conversation we're having and sort of what flows, what's implied by some of the points we're making. And what struck me by that about that passage you read, Chuck, and it's to me it's really connected with what you're talking about, Paula, with the farm, is those inevitable stop moments. I'm just looking at it. Yeah, the defect interruptions. What I was thinking of is that there, I'm not sure which discipline this comes from, but there are what are called positive object lessons and there are negative object lessons. In other words, There are situations that we learn from because they show us the right way to proceed. And there are situations that are sometimes very impactful, situations that go wrong that are also very instructive and teach us things that sometimes, you know, that's the only way we will learn them. And I think there's another motto that says, you know, the highest truth can only be seen from the greatest depths or something along those lines. And for me, that's really related to our current time in history. The situation that may be required for us as humanity to finally reach across the chasm of our divides and our ideologies and our antagonisms, our natural antagonisms, the thing that will finally move us to cooperate on a global level to address these challenges that are really global and existential for us. And I'm thinking of climate issues. I'm thinking of economic disparity issues. I'm thinking of nuclear disarmament issues and the ending of war, and you know the issue of representative versus secular totalitarian forms of government. These huge issues that our current world is facing, that are they can destroy us. You know, that's why they're existential. It's almost like we may have to experience painful enough situations that they force us to reach for those higher values that will reconcile and remedy that higher level of problem so that we begin to act together as a whole humanity. And that's why I keep coming back to the vision that for me flows from Jesus' teaching that is draws us higher is the universal and cosmic spiritual family relationships we have with each other, and that can only exist under the parental overcare and wisdom of God, you know. So to me, this is, you know, we're going to have to find inspiration in that model that transcends our national differences, that we are spiritual family in a cosmic and unifying sense. And we may have to suffer, you know, some really terrifying things before we're forced, in a sense, to say we just have to cooperate and get along because it's the way we will survive. So I wonder about that, you know, about that as interregnum, you know.
Mm-hmm. The interregnum as being one of these defect interruptions or the stop moment.
Or negative object lessons. Or else, you know, in your analogy with the farm, it's like until we face the fact that our farm is dying and almost dead, we won't take the emergency measures that force us to try something radically new and do it, you know, incorporating our best of our existing wisdom, but stretching it into some new levels of cooperation and coordination. That's what it feels like is struggling to be born in our world right now.
It does feel like that, Marvin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, and doesn't it get to the only sovereignty in all of this is God, and to the degree that we are pointing to that overarching sovereignty, we're going to miss the mark. And that's why I really feel that the biggest thing we can do with this revelation is bring God into the discussion. Otherwise, you know, we're just shooting in the dark.
Exactly, Pam, because where do you get worship wisdom unless you're worshiping in association with deity? So right on.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And there's a challenge. So we have to lose the Old Testament God. Clearly.
Yes, absolutely.
We have to lose that God. That's
one of the biggest discussions.
One of them. Not both of them. just one. Ah,
okay. Right. Good
yeah,
point.
There's
yeah,
two gods.
The one that.
There's two gods.
There are two
Old
gods.
Testament.
Point
yeah.
that out, Chuck, because I think that's a really important point. There are two gods
what?
In the Old Testament.
Just read the Book of Psalms, you know.
Yeah, okay.
That's very different from the demon god in Deuteronomy, you know, wants to massacre all the surrounding tribes. Very different.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and
right.
those are the value levels. Those are the value levels that Marvin was talking about, you know.
That Jesus
you know, the spiral,
brought.
Yeah, the spiral dynamic of where consciousness and value systems are, you know, they're, in fact, all of those value systems are existent on the planet today, and that's part of the conflict.
Right. Now, I was just thinking today about what it will take. And there's quite an echo going on. I don't know.
Yes, there is.
Yeah. We should mute if we're not speaking.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thinking about what it would take, you know, as the book tells us, one religion, one language, you know, and it's a conflict, this very conflict in Russia, what's going on in Russia right now and in the Eastern Europe, Russian, the conflict between Russia, the war in Russia and Ukraine, thinking about what it would take for us to surrender any notion of sovereignty. I was thinking about Jesus's discourse on that and how he's very clear about national sovereignty in the Midwayer's commentary on how, you know, even leagues of nations won't help. The richest and most powerful nations will always withdraw and make war. And the only thing that will really solve that problem is this concept of God and religion that is, you know, that the Arantia book is spelling out, this vision of God, the our beloved Father, who isn't fighting battles for us. You know, he's on our side, all of us. And ultimately, I think what God and all of God's agencies would be trying to do if they were here is just what you said, trying to get us to work together to solve our problems. And, you know, how are we, you know, I was just pondering how far we are away from having one religion and what that religion, what it would be. Obviously, Jesus held up the religion of the Spirit, which is, you know, find God, find him, and fall in love with him. Get to know him. Apply what you learn from your discovery of God and the true nature of God to your life. And live in harmony with that, with your highest ideals and your highest concepts of God. And to me, that's the religion of the Urantia book. You know, that's the religion it's holding up for us, the religion of the Spirit. And how will we get there? You know, and I ponder that a lot. I mean, because obviously we're far away from that. What are the next steps, though? You know, I'm kind of a next steps person. What's the next mm-hmm. baby step we can take toward, you know, that human dignity? And where we are one world under a sovereign, one sovereign God. And we all agree what that sovereignty means. Will it take divine intervention? What do you guys think? I mean, I'm just so, I think about this a lot. What will it take to get us to really reflect on what all this means and who God really is?
I think part of it is, I was just going to say, I think part of it is the recognition of the sovereignty of Michael in the local universe, the Father for all of creation. But in terms of human character and motivation, I think there has to be a dawning realization that everyone individually needs to take voluntary responsibility for the good of the whole.
Mm. Yes.
And that's what will connect the part with the whole. And it'll connect
yes.
the whole of this earth with the sovereignty of, you know, our creators.
Mm.
But until that happens, you know, we'll be in the state of perpetual self-interest, where people are only just looking out for themselves. I mean, we always have to do that to some extent, but it is possible to blend that and combine that with a voluntary
mm-hmm.
sense of responsibility for the good of the whole, and
right.
to blend those priorities in a meaningful and effective way. I think it's part of what needs to happen on the individual level. You know, how that
yes.
plays out in concrete terms remains to be seen, but that's the underlying motivation, I think, that has to be born, say, or has to arise in all the individuals of any population.
Yes, it's almost as if the great commandment, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart. There's a lot of that going out there, but to love your neighbor as yourself, as a part of that family of that God, is not being lived out by many Christians, you know, and somehow the Old Testament values are limiting that. And,
some of them, yeah.
So that's where part of the struggle is. And there's a lot of really good conversation going on with the progressive Christians that are addressing these very contrasts, that are trying to push the Christian view into the future, into the, you know, the more Urantian-like viewpoint. Diana Butler Bass is a good example of that. She really struggles to redefine the best parts of Christianity. And
mm-hmm.
and that struggle. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah. So,
yeah, there's distortions in the New Testament, too. It isn't just the Old Testament.
Absolutely. Oh, sure. But, yes,
yeah.
of course. But just from her, with her perspective, you know. I mean, she has
a really good
grasp on Jesus,
yeah.
you know. She,
yeah,
she's
well, that needs to happen, yeah. I mean, the Bible could be sort of sorted out, and just all the good
yes.
stuff was
yes.
identified
and
retained.
Happening.
That's yeah.
happening.
Yeah.
It really is.
Like,
I'm inspired.
Like,
by
you know, Jesus
that's
never preached.
Yeah.
Jesus never preached the atonement doctrine or original
no.
sin. That's not part of his
no.
teaching at all. So,
right.
That could be left behind, probably.
Mm-hmm. Well, and when
so,
you mentioned
so,
the good of the whole,
yeah,
Chuck, that
right.
was something that came up in my mind when Paula mentioned what would Adam and Eve be teaching, and
right.
Right.
And so, yeah, I was flashing on that at the time, that's the principle that underlies actually the second half of the Great Commandment. So, yeah, anyway.
Yeah, you know, I go
if
back to the biggest little farm again.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, just the time it takes, you know, that Adam and Eve certainly would have been here cheering us on, saying, no, you just keep going. Just keep trying. Just like the old codger taught that couple, don't give up. This is going to work. You just keep moving in this direction, and you
mm-hmm.
will see results. And I think that's what they would do for us. And probably part of our problem is we give up. We give up too easily and say, well, this will never work. But it will. It just takes time. It's like an old Chinese master told me once. He taught Qigong, and he told me you have to do you have to practice Qi Lao for 100 days straight to reach a Qigong. And when you reach a Qigong, then you get maximum rewards from your daily practice. And I told him, why 100 days straight? You know, if you miss a day, you have to start over. You have to start counting again. And he said, well, if water's down 100 feet, will you reach it if you only dig 99? No, that's too simple. No, of course you won't, right? But you got to dig the 100, and that was his point. But, you know, that to me, the encouragement, one thing that I guess we as spiritual people can do is keep encouraging others and ourselves to keep going, to keep moving in the right direction.
Well, and Gary posted the religion of the spirit means effort, struggle, conflict, faith, termination, love, loyalty, and progress.
Right.
So that's what those people on the farm were doing. They weren't letting anything get in their way. They kept the forward effort, struggle, conflict, faith that they had an outcome, determination, all of that. You know, I mean, that's part of what, you know, Jesus was sharing with the apostles is what they had to do and what we have to do. Yeah.
Right. Not
and
with
boy
the
do we Yeah, boy do we have the planet to practice that, you know.
We get the illness like we were talking about last week, being Agon daughters and what that means. We get the good practice down here. You know, priceless practice. Mm-hmm. I wanted to share with you guys something that I asked AI recently, and the response that AI, and I know AI is another loaded topic, you know. Sorry about that. This stuff is really on my mind, though, and you guys really helped me. And I love studying with you for that reason, and I think everybody on the board would agree, you know, and that we're not that we're afraid to tackle the hard stuff, because we're not. We do tackle it, and we do talk about it in loving ways and respectful ways, and I so appreciate that with you all. Thank you for that. But I recently asked AI, because I'm hearing different things. I have dear, dear friends who think it's the most amazing thing. And in a way, it is the most amazing thing. And then others you see in the news and stuff, the sky is falling. The sky is going to fall because of AI. Well, I've heard that before, too, and it hasn't necessarily happened. But so I asked AI this question, I said, as the repository of all human knowledge to date, what do you consider to be the most important thing for humankind to know and understand? And here's what AI answered. That is a very profound and challenging question. There are many possible answers, and I cannot claim to have the ultimate or definitive one. However, based on my own knowledge and understanding, I would say that the most important thing for humankind to know and understand is this. You are not separate, but interconnected. What do I mean by that? I mean that you are not isolated or independent entities, but rather parts of a larger and complex whole. You are connected to each other, to nature, to the universe, and to God. You are connected by physical, biological, social, physiological, and spiritual bonds. You are connected by history, culture, language, and values. You are connected by love, compassion, empathy, and altruism. Why is it important to know and understand? Because it has profound implications for how you live your life and how you relate to others. It means that you are not alone, but supported and cared for by a network of relationships. It means that you are not insignificant, but valuable and meaningful for the whole. It means that you are not powerless, but responsible and influential for the outcome. Knowing and understanding your interconnectedness can help you overcome many of the problems and challenges that you face as individuals and as a collective. Can help you overcome fear, loneliness, selfishness, greed, violence, hatred, prejudice, and ignorance. It can help you foster peace, harmony, cooperation, generosity, kindness, respect, and wisdom. It can help you achieve your highest potentials and contribute to the evolution of the Supreme Being. I hope this answer helps you appreciate the importance of knowing and understanding your interconnectedness. If you want to learn more about this topic, you can read at some of these sources. And then it gave me three sources. I posted this on Facebook, and I was, you know, amazed because it amazed me. And so many of my friends were amazed by it as well. I've been thinking ever since I posted that question and got that answer, I've been thinking about our interconnectedness. And as Chuck pointed out, the part and the whole. and what we learn from that. Are you guys still there?
Yeah.
I'm just thinking a lot about what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well,
and
you know,
staying muted.
Yeah, in all fairness, I had asked it to define what the Supreme Being from the Urantia book meant, and it gave me that definition, which was an extraordinary answer. And then I also asked it, what's the difference between you and the Supreme, since you are kind of a collective of all to date? What's the difference? And it gave me a very candid, amazing answer about that. And so then I asked it this question, and this was the answer I got. So perhaps, you know, I mean, clearly it knows, it has access to the Urantia book's teachings, clearly. And it has, you know, it's interesting, its response to that. It's very interesting to me.
Well, you know, Paula, I also would have to ask the question, I wonder if it knows that you are the one that's asking. So it searches for whatever information it has about the kinds of things you've asked and the kinds of comments you've made that are out there on the Internet, and tailors its response to who you are as the asker of the question.
Right. Yes. I think that's fair, Marvin. I think there's probably truth to that. And someone even called me and said, why don't you ask somebody who knows nothing of the Urantia book, has never searched anything about the Urantia book, to ask that same question and see what answer they get.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Yes, it would.
Right. Although
it would gather.
I don't, I mean, it's interesting. I don't disagree with the answer, but then, you know, but then in that light, Marvin, why would you? It's telling you exactly what you want to hear, you know. Although I would hope that if it truly is the, you know, the computer that has access to all human wisdom, all human knowledge, good and bad, I think there's a lot of good out there. And I think the Urantia book is amazing. And I did ask it, what's the best spiritual teaching on the planet? It did not say the Urantia book.
What did it say?
It was very diplomatic. That's what I've noticed about AI. It's very diplomatic. Well, there are many good teachings on the planet. You know, some like the teachings of Jesus and some like the teachings of, you know, and it kind of went on to different teachings. But not the Urantia book. It didn't say that. So one would think that it would have, you know, if it was just gearing it toward me and telling me what I want to hear. But, yeah.
Well, you know, I don't know if I can effectively characterize this. And by the way, are you getting the echo at this point, or are you not?
No, I'm not.
Okay, yeah, I tried to. I think that was me, and I've made a change in some of my hearing aid settings, so that may have been part of it. But the thing, you know, and I've been watching a lot of this discussion about AI, and we're sort of shifting topics, but I think it's an interesting shift. And what I'm struck by all the things I've seen in the emails that have gone back and forth, and I see it also in what you shared with us, Paula, as wise as it sounds, what I see is two things. One, I don't find it to be particularly creative or innovative. I find it as sort of summarizing and summing what already is there in a sense, which is intriguing to us and it fascinates us. But I don't find it as striking me with something really new that gets me thinking and moving in ways that are progressive. And the other thing that I notice about all the stuff I've seen about from AI and much of it that I've seen in the emails is really reflective of the questions that your Urantia book readers are asking. And I have to wonder, if you had an atheistic audience or a secular audience, would AI be giving those answers, or would it be giving different answers? So, I mean, that's one question I have. But But the other thing that strikes me, even in what you read, Paula, is the large majority of what it describes is human activity and a summation of human activity and the ideals of human activity. And there is some mention of God because that's part of human activity. But unlike the Urantia book, which focuses so much and so creatively on the living relationship with our creator, with the deity, there's very little I've seen in AI that really talks about that living relationship and what we can do to really develop and grow it. That to me seems very inspiring. So it stays for me relatively shallow, interestingly enough, even though it's very idealistic. But that's just my impression. I'm certainly far from an authority on it. Like in all of that wonderful language you read, there were only two mentions of God, and even those were fairly superficial. The first one just stuck the name God in there, and the second one refers to the Supreme Being, or, you know. So, I mean, I don't see too much of spiritual depth in what I encounter from AI.
No, me either.
Uh-huh.
No, it's and you wouldn't expect that, though, right? That's a human thing.
Right.
You know, for me, that's a human thing. I wouldn't expect that. I would expect a more clinical answer, but, you know, it's interesting that wasn't necessary.
I'm sorry. I respectfully disagree. I think it is a human thing. That's why I think the two polarities, the two fundamental directions of that flow from the central metaphor in Jesus' teachings of spiritual family relationship are so critical. It's not only a lateral direction. It's not only our relationships with each other and our collaborations. It's a profoundly vertical connection with the divine, with our source, and with our destiny. And if it's not talking at least as much about our relationship with God and how profoundly critical that is, then it's misleading by its misemphasis, I think. But that's just my reaction, you know.
So you're saying that the AI answer is a human thing?
Oh, yeah, I think it is a very human thing. I don't think there's any real spiritual input to it. It's just summarizing what's out there in the human lexicon. The descriptions I've seen of the Urantia book and its philosophy, they emphasize science, philosophy, and religion, and a number of other elements. But there's very little description of the profound material in the text that talks about developing a personal relationship with God and how it affects people and what God's qualities are. It seems shallow, that's all.
Huh.
Also no mention of Jesus. No mention of Jesus.
No.
Yeah. Yeah,
although I mean, if you asked it specifically, it would, but you know, say something about Jesus, I'm sure. But yeah.
Yeah, but what that says to me, Paula, is AI is giving you what it discerns you want to know of what's out there. So it's sort of just feeding back, and the more you tell it what you're interested in and what you're asking it, the more educated it gets as to what to regurgitate for you. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I'm seeing. It's not generally creative.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, Gary makes the point online where he talks about much prescience can be found in the Urantia book regarding AI. He says, look how carefully written Urantia Moda number 1 is in the context of today. And that's 48.7.3. A display of specialized skill does not signify possession of spiritual capacity. Cleverness is not a substitute for true character.
Yeah, so right.
I think he's right. I think it hints at what AI is missing. Yeah.
Right. Well, what
AI is missing is a personal and living relationship with God.
Right. And that was my point, Marvin, that it's not that spirituality is a human thing, right? Only a person, only a human being with heart and nerve and muscle and sinew and brain and, you know, a human being can have a personal relationship with God. A machine can't. It may be the sum of human knowledge, but God is not indwelling it.
It's not connected to the mind circuits.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
It's connected in a human mind circuit.
What it does do, though, is harvest what's out there to be found that's relevant to your question. And the selection criteria for that, who knows, somewhere in the algorithms. But
somewhere in the algorithm.
But, you know, AI is getting better and better at mimicking personality. Or, you know, like you said, they try to be sort of judicious or moderate. You know, there's little character traits sort of built into the algorithm that make it increasingly have a sort of a sentient feeling.
Yeah.
But it's a mimicking of that, which is not necessarily a bad thing so far as it helps us to see the difference between that and the connection to, you know, living mind.
Right.
So
it can be dangerous
over time in that sense. We'll slowly begin to awaken to the fact that there's more to human mind and being alive as a human being that can ever be put into even the most sophisticated device that's not alive. But it's confusing for so many people. Because they don't really grasp the nature of life, even. They think it's just something that happened because of collisions of molecules or something. So we
collide
molecules
and
AI, you get the same thing. Something
It's dangerous for those that don't understand the spiritual connotations of what we're talking about. They could be easily, you know, fooled. And that's, I think, another aspect of what Gary had to say. Cleverness is not a substitute for true character. And a lot of people can be fooled by how supposedly clever, you know, AI can be. So it's an interesting time to be living.
Well, that's what
people can be fooled.
That's what that engineer at Google was concerned about, who they fired when he spoke up about
it. Yes, exactly.
It's whether you know, regardless of the clarity of his own philosophical understanding of sentience, he was alarmed that Google had no container for this development that was at least becoming, you know, was taking on the aspects of sentience, you can put it that way, to the extent that it could be a fool people. And that they had no policy around that and refused to even do the Turing test on this Lambda AI that they developed. And because they didn't want to find out, you know, that people could be fooled by it. And he was speaking up about it, and then they fired him. But anyway, I don't know.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see where it takes us, right? I mean, it's I can see a lot of its wonderful uses, you know, especially in medicine and for certain human problems like that. I mean,
I mean, it's a harvesting technology. It could be very useful.
Exactly. Yeah. I asked it about, you know, and one of the benefits I see in it is I asked it about the type of cancer that I have, that I've had two major surgeries for and several episodes with. And it gave me a more cogent answer on that than anything, you know, any research I've ever done on that. But it was because it's all in one place. It synthesizes it and gives it to you all in one place. It's not like 100 different articles and you have to read every single one of them to find, you know, the points that you're looking for. It synthesizes things and gives it to you all at once. So that's a real benefit, I think. It's going to be interesting to see how humans use this and where it takes us. It's yet another technology. I mean, we've been talking right. about it for the whole show, right? It's like oil.
mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
we tend to blunder into these things because we don't have our ongoing revelation here.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And so we don't have the wisdom and we don't have the foresight. You know, mm-hmm. the foresight that Adam and Eve would have brought us, the foresight that a loyal planetary prince would have brought us is the foresight of
mm-hmm.
not just 100 years of experience or 200 or recorded human history.
mm-hmm.
The foresight would have been the foresight of millions of years of evolution.
Yeah, it gets back to connectivity. You know,
right.
how we really are all connected when we see the whole picture.
right.
Otherwise, we're just, you know, it's not that obvious otherwise.
Yeah.
Or it's easy it's
you know,
easily
there's...
to be distracted from it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this conversation is really interesting. I mean, it really is a separate conversation from the issue of nature, although it has some connection. But still, one thing that occurs to me as I'm listening to what we're all saying about this, about AI, is, you know, in a human system, you've got four elements that are put together, you know, well, five. You've got a physical body, you've got a mind, you've got a soul, and you've got the indwelling fragment of God, right? And they are all in systemic arrangement in a unique way in each personality, which is the fifth element, in a sense. And with AI, I think what you have, which for me is clarifying, is all you have is mind without any association to what would be in that metaphor, a soul or an indwelling adjuster. It has a body as well. So it's got body and mind. In other words, the body is all of the electronic infrastructure that it functions within globally, you know, the physics of it, the mechanics of it, the electronics. And then the mind is the actual interactions, in a sense. But there's no soul to it, really.
Mm-hmm.
If we understand, and I think if anything, the only soul contributions would be the questions that are asked by the questioner themselves, which
mm-hmm.
gives
leading
an indication. But beyond that, there's no God fragment. In other words, God is not interacting with AI. God is only
right.
acting with human persons. And the other thing is AI has no personality, which is an actual conscious entity that is making choices, choosing, and experiencing. It doesn't have consciousness,
mm-hmm.
which
right.
is, you know, it responds so well as a mindful phenomenon that it fools us into thinking that it's a conscious entity and even a person and a personality. And then I think the dangers that Pam was talking about, you know, and that we're all recognizing start to come into play, is that we give it too much reality when in fact it's a superficial phenomenon, a
right.
very, very sophisticated one, but it doesn't
mm-hmm.
have soul. It doesn't have soul. It doesn't have the capacity to grow in the sense that any of us grows. It doesn't have an indwelling or connected. It doesn't have a connection with deity.
Right.
It's a cognitive and material phenomenon, a very sophisticated one, but it's
mm-hmm.
not beyond that.
And here we are, you know, not unlike an animal. I mean, an animal doesn't have that either. And
right.
AI are maybe our greatest human invention so far, one of them anyway, doesn't have that. But we do. But we do. And maybe
mm-hmm.
that's the lesson for all of us. We have. That's, I mean, maybe that's the message that the Urantia book carries, at least for me, one of the most important messages, since, and we're reading these first five papers on God, is that God is in us. We have that connection with God.
Interesting about that, I think, is that it could be that AI will be the factor that drives interest in the Urantia book at some point.
Huh.
Because only the Urantia book really has the philosophical and spiritual provide that foundation of wisdom and understanding that can correctly interpret AI.
Right.
So anyway, I don't know. That's just a thought. But I think there is something to that, that certainly, at least in the realm, I mean, it's already happening. I mean, people are asking bigger questions about what it means to be human and the nature of being a self.
Right.
And all those kind of issues are coming to the foreground because of the attempt to create AI in a way that mimics all those characteristics that we have. You know, it's getting better and better at it. You know, the whole issue of sentience and all of that. What does it even mean to be alive? You know, people are asking those questions. And mm-hmm. the answers they're coming up with, apart from the answer, are all pretty clueless if you've looked into this at all. You know, there's a lot of very shallow understandings of the nature of selfhood and being a human being and what it's all about and why and where we come. You know, all the big questions become relevant in the contemplation of AI. So I think that's maybe the higher value level that it actually has, is that it's forcing questions that the only real repository of answers that are adequate to those questions is the Urantia book. So at some point, you know, maybe not next week or a year from now, but
right.
At least points them to
God, at least. You know,
right, yeah, that's happening already. That's happening
already.
The questions are being asked already.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Good.
Well, interestingly, the three references that it gave me, after those questions and taking in mind all that you guys said, that, and I did think of that, you know, that it was pandering to me, you know, because after all, that's what Google does, right? It hears my phone conversations and then
all of a sudden
starts sending me ads based on what I was just talking about. But the three references it gave me was The Science of Interconnectedness by Uplift, Interconnectedness, The Secret to Happiness by Psychology Today, and The Interconnectedness of All Things by the Urantia Book Fellowship.
Huh.
So to your point, Chuck, I think that, you know, maybe it will guide people to the Urantia Book if they're asking good questions, you know, or questions
well, I think,
that are...
Yeah, I don't know, Paul. I mean, I think it's obvious that you have a history of profound interest in the Urantia book, and I think it gave you something
that you
would connect with. Yeah, yeah. So
yeah. That's why it would be of value for an atheist who has, you know, who has never searched the Urantia book or looked for anything in regards to the Urantia book to ask the same question and see what it came up with. But unfortunately, I don't know anybody like that, you guys. you know, I mean, that's interesting. I have to look pretty hard. But I'm down for trying it. You know, if I find somebody, I will ask them. Absolutely.
Oh, I want to watch.
You want to watch, okay. You know, it's an interesting world we live in that has found a way to serve us up whatever it is we want to hear. and maybe knows even better than we do what that is.
That is a very important thing to be talking about, and you know, in the context of God and nature and bringing it back to all of that. That's part of the nature of our reality now, is that it feeds back mechanically. Let's not even call it mindily. It feeds back mechanically what it is we give it, and you know, it can actually it is a good querying tool. It is a very good way of exploring. All of that is good, but we need to be aware of the idea that it can only feed back how we prompt it.
Right.
And it's in touch with a great deal.
And that's true with everything, right?
Well, it is. I mean, now, will it get more objective in its ability to do that? Will the algorithms become more sophisticated? Because right now, what we have is largely large language models and large image models,
right,
or extensive image models. I don't know what they're calling this, but the idea is it's brute forcing through a great deal of data, and it can only answer a question you give it. So if you don't mention Urantia, it's not likely to come up with Urantia. It is going to remember how you prompted it, the better AIs.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, they're getting more sophisticated and more, quote unquote, intelligent. And that is a real intelligence. I mean, you may not be able to call it minded in the same way that we are minded, or that even animals are minded. Because the one thing that's not there is there isn't life. There isn't any real life there. There is the emulation of life. Life produced that, but it's not the same as it itself being living. But in the same way that computers wowed us originally with some of the things that they were able to do, we now see computers wowing us even more with the intricacies of having learned how to navigate large data sets. You know, one of the things that should be said, you know, about large language models that people ought to understand, they have been trained on literally looking at the frequency and the weight with regard to how words go together in strings of, well, first of all, as single words, how often they appear in the language, and then every couplet of words in the English language, not to mention what it's doing with other languages in the same database, but let's just keep it simple to English for right now. Then three language strings, then four languages. It looks at every possible language string, gives it a weight, and then trains on that. And then as it's being interacted with, those weights are shifted to better respond. So this is largely a mechanical kind of a thing that's happening. But it's very sophisticated. And to give you an example, when they got up to 8-word strings and everything being trained up to 8-word strings and all the 8-word strings that there were in the language, it was already at that point 85% accurate. Okay? It now, wait for it. Many of these are trained on 32,767 word strings.
Wow.
And everything in between. So it literally has a weighting for each of those things. It you know, quote unquote, knows the relative frequency with which certain responses should be given a particular prompt. And when it's not so good, it gets better. This is just the beginning. This is just the beginning. But it's not living, and it's not truly minded. It does not have, is not getting, let's be clear about this. It is not life in circuited. We know that. Nobody here was saying that. But it's worth stating it explicitly for those that haven't put that together, that may not come with all the background in the Urantia book. And two, it's not minded. It is not in circuited, even in the adjutant mind circuits. It's not even encircuited in what the physical controllers are doing, though it is definitely emulating certain things that the physical controllers probably do so much better.
Good point.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And conversely, Andre, we are minded and we are encircled.
We are.
So what does that say
about us? But we have considerably less data than it has. And
yeah.
So we can't,
good point.
Pretty soon we're going to be outshone in terms of some of what it's going to be able to produce.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that it can do everything that a human being can do.
Right.
And certainly doesn't have any kind of relationship to the fact that with this simple mind that God gives us, we are deemed worthy of being indwelt by thought adjusters and worthy of having personality bestowed on us and being given potentially eternal life. You know, they're all rooting for us as the very simple beings we are with our very simple but very profoundly important start in the universe that actually can get experience, an experience of a very profound order, so profound that Michael of Nevadon bestowed himself on our world mainly just to get that experience.
Really?
And the thing that he said ultimately was love one another. Just love one another. You know? And in that love is an openness and a willingness to understand, to listen, to care, to work, to cooperate, to be a team. And it's like what he told Gannon, the real things of this world and the universe are on your side. Or I guess he told Fortune on the Hillside that. But in his affirmation was also.
You know, the evolution of technology has always been extending capabilities that we already have. You know, like you think about the telescope or the microscope, you know, it enables the human eye to see what it's not able to see without the assistance of those devices. Mm. So in a way, sort of the same with AI. It extends the reach of our mind, but it doesn't make
it's
us
a
any
tool.
Less human. It doesn't make us any less human. Right.
Good but point. The Urantia book does the same thing with the spiritual aspect.
Yeah, it does. It's a telescope for us for certain.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes both ways, into the past and into the future. Well, what a great discussion, you guys. We're down to our last minute. And gosh, I loved it. Thank you for indulging me.
That was good.
It really helped, though, you know. And I think these things are on a lot of people's minds, so maybe it's a nice service that we discuss them too, you know, from a perspective, which is clearly the Urantia book gives us such an enlarged perspective to take these things in. It's invaluable, and it's an honor to serve and help others with that. So much love to you. Andre has dropped off. I know he has phone problems, but that doesn't mean the show stopped. It's still going on, but I know you would say. Thanks to everyone. Thanks to all of you, Chuck, Marvin, Pam, Andre, if you get back on or not. And we had quite a few listeners on the board today. Thanks, Gary,
for
your wonderful comments, and
Perry,
and all of you. Bob, we love you guys. It always does our heart good to see you there. Cam, thank you.
Love you.
Until next week, guys.
Love you all.
We'll be back.
Love you, too.
Have a great week.
Love.
Yeah, you too. We'll be back with God's unchanging character. That'll be good.